Welcome to the podcast series, Intel on AI. Each episode explores human-centric topics related to artificial intelligence through conversations with leaders in the field. I'm your host, Abigail Hing Nguyen. With me today is Colin Murdoch, a member of DeepMind's executive committee. I've been interested in the work of DeepMind since before it became a subsidiary of Google. DeepMind is a UK-based artificial intelligence company and research lab focused on building safe AI systems. Like many of our listeners, I'm guessing, I first heard of DeepMind through its program AlphaGo, the first computer program to defeat a human world champion in the game of Go. And today, DeepMind is engaged in many more other groundbreaking challenges. So I'm very excited to explore them with Colin today. Colin, thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, Abby. It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me. Really looking forward to our conversation.
Can you start off by telling our listeners about your role at DeepMind and what brought you there?
Yeah, for sure. So maybe it's worth just saying a bit more about DeepMind to begin with, because actually that's pretty connected to my role and actually why I joined DeepMind. So DeepMind was founded actually just over 10 years ago now with a really ambitious vision of developing advanced AI and kind of using that for positive benefit throughout the world. And I think I probably came across DeepMind about 7 years ago. So I was lucky enough to have a friend that joined DeepMind. And this was before DeepMind was acquired by Google. She introduced me to DeepMind. And when I discovered the mission of DeepMind, it kind of really caught me, this amazing mission of solving intelligence and thinking about the kind of many possibilities of that. I've always been kind of really into technology. I remember as a kid, my first computer was a Sinclair ZX81. And discovering the many things you could kind of do with this box if you could program it in the right way. Even from that age, I could maybe feel the kind of power of these kind of digital technologies. And roll forward quite a few years, coming across this amazing mission and beginning to imagine the possibilities. But actually, at that time, DeepMind was still hiring kind of just research scientists primarily. And my background is really at that intersection of technology and business. And so the time wasn't right then, but actually a year or so later, Google acquired DeepMind and was beginning to expand. And that was the time when I think I had my first conversation with Demis Hassabis, the CEO and founder of DeepMind, and was kind of hooked from that point onwards. And that was just over 6 years ago now.
Great. Well, let's dig in. Solving intelligence, which is one of the goals of DeepMind, you know, reaching artificial general intelligence, is a bit of a controversial topic. There are skeptics out there that aren't sure we will ever reach it. And there are obviously others who believe it's just around the corner. But either way, on the road to reaching artificial general intelligence, there are many innovations that get thrown off. And it seems that's actually a big part of your role, taking these innovations and finding problems for them to solve or finding applications. I'd love to explore this further with you.
Yeah, I think something that I thought about a lot when I was joining DeepMind was that question of intelligence. And what I realized was we have a proof point, and that is actually ourselves, right? We are intelligent beings. So for me, it became partly a matter of when rather than if. And not just this event in the future, but actually this kind of value along the way, as I think about it, this kind of growing cone of capability. And you're absolutely right. My role at DeepMind is to, if you like, look at the exhaust of our amazing research program. So it's an incredible place to work. And I'm very privileged to be able to work with the team at DeepMind to identify research that looks like it has real world potential. And then partner with our colleagues at Google to think about ways that we can apply that in the real world.
Can you share about some of the areas that you're particularly excited about?
You know what? I think one of my favorite examples is the work we've done in text-to-speech. So this is a system that takes in text and creates human-sounding, realistic speech. And if you've ever been on a call to your bank or any other kind of organization and you've kind of been on the receiving end of one of these computer voices, you know, it can be quite jarring, particularly when you're in a kind of long queue. And of course, you know, voice interaction is something actually which is appearing all over the place now. And so voice as an interface is something that's incredibly important. And we expect, I think, to be maybe a kind of dominant interface for how we interact with the world and with computers in the future. So being able to create a human realistic automated voice, I think is something really powerful and I think could really have a major impact. And I think it's something that I think computer scientists have been trying to do for years, if not decades, is to achieve that. And so one of my favorite examples is we were, in tracking our research, able to identify a kind of piece of research that looked like it had some early promise. And then over the coming months, really develop that with our colleagues at Google also into a system we call WaveNet, which is now, I'm really proud to say, I think running on pretty much all Google product services and devices. and not just in English, actually, in kind of multiple languages. You might call it the voice of Google in some sense. And I think that is one of my favorite examples, because I think it reaches the lives of billions of people around the world now. And that is from a small seed that grew out of DeepMind. And in the end, that's, I think, what my role is about. How do we kind of take that technology at DeepMind and make it available to the world?
And where would you run into this? Is this in our Google Home devices or maybe on our phones?
Yeah, those are good examples, and on your phones. And there's a product called Google Assistant, which is another great example. So on pretty much any service where you are interacting with Google, you're going to be listening to that voice created by DeepMind.
What are some of the other applications you're looking ahead to?
Well, you can imagine how this could be used maybe in an enterprise setting. So I've talked a bit about how we as kind of users of these products experience it. But going back to my mobile banking example, you know, there are lots of organizations that run contact centers. You've experienced them, we've all experienced them. So I think there's a really great opportunity to take this technology, package it up, and make it available to enterprises so they can really enhance their services as well. That's a great example. There may be other opportunities in, you know, looking at videos or video content and maybe taking that and translating it into other languages. And that can be anything from content we just enjoy to watch to actually, I think, what could be really powerful, kind of educational content in one language and translating that into kind of any number of languages to make that much more accessible to folks around the world.
Well, Colin, I'd love to transition now into some of the applications of DeepMind's work into the greater world. Last year, I wrote about AlphaFold for Forbes AI, and I gave a keynote in Beijing about the work that DeepMind has been doing towards solving the protein folding problem. As you know, it's one of the grand research problems in biology. It's concerned with how an amino acid sequence determines the three-dimensional structure of a protein, which in turn governs the protein's ability to perform its functions. Now, at the time I was writing, AlphaFold was able to accurately predict 25 out of 43 protein structures correctly, and it's obviously made many other headlines since. I wanted to say congratulations on your most recent announcements and would love to hear the update on the latest breakthroughs.
Yeah, it's been a truly exceptional last couple of weeks, actually. So we entered this competition CASC, which is set up by scientists many years ago to help accelerate and advance research into understanding how proteins fold. And as you said, Abigail, understanding how proteins fold is really essential to understanding their function. And what was truly amazing was that we've been able to really push the state of the art to a point where we think we are now kind of competitive with experimental methods, which means that we can do on a computer what would normally require years or months of painstaking work. We achieved a score of 92.4 GDT. So you kind of think of the kind of 100 as a perfect score, and 92.4 is, you know, pretty much as good as you can get. So we've really advanced state of the art to that level. So I think the really interesting metric to think about here is the GDT score. So zero is the kind of you can't predict anything, and 100 is you're predicting absolutely everything perfectly. And a couple of years ago, teams were hovering at around 50, and we really kind of pushed that up a notch. And I think what's been absolutely remarkable over the last 2 years in this latest CASP competition is that we've gone from that level to 92.4, which is based on where we were last year, kind of really incredibly pushed the state of the art. And I think it's been great to see actually how our work from the last CASP competition has been reused by the CASP community, and they've been able to incorporate some of our advancements into their own algorithms and their own approaches and the human contributions to those. So they've also lifted up their results. And I think it's fair to say that the team at DeepMind has really blended out of the water here and has really kind of changed the way I think we're going to have to think about this competition in the future. And it's kind of really important to say then that, as you said, Abigail, this has been one of the grand challenges. And I think it's safe to say that we've pretty much solved it. I think these are things that ever solved, but we've pretty much solved this. So we can start to think about, well, what can we do with this next? That's where my mind's beginning to go. Yeah, so there's always the continuing science. I think your work's never done as a scientist. And I think there's going to be more work on the scientific side and working with our great collaborators and the rest of the scientific community to continue to explore on the research side. And then, you know, it's difficult for me not to think about kind of where we could go from a business perspective, you know, start to think about some of the applications. I'd love to think about if we can help businesses in their drug discovery, so pharma in their drug discovery processes, how can we now use this new AlphaFold, we call it AlphaFold 2, to help accelerate drug discovery? That would be amazing. Another example is around new materials. How can we use our kind of understanding of proteins to think about the design of new materials? There's any number of different applications. And I'm super excited to, as well as push the research, begin to think how we could maybe help businesses and organizations use the technology to really move forward their businesses. It's one of those kind of once in a lifetime or once in a generation breakthroughs. It's been really a very proud moment for everyone, the community and everyone at DeepMind to really be part of that. It's been really, truly amazing.
And there's also promise around potentially identifying dysfunctions and foldings that could cause, say, allergies or diseases like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or cystic fibrosis. Are there specific areas or specific diseases that you feel are the most promising candidates or targets for the work that's coming out of AlphaFold?
You know, I think the exciting thing is it's not going to be specific to one disease. I expect it to be applicable across the range. And I think that is the kind of power of being able to do this in the way that we've done it, is that I think ordinarily you might need to kind of focus in and narrow it necessarily because of the constraints of the natural systems you're dealing with. But when I think about AlphaFold, I think the kind of really beautiful and powerful thing is it's all of those. We hope to apply it in all of those different areas. And I think that is actually the power you get from these computational digital methods that allows you to scale in a way that's just as impossible if you're taking more traditional approaches.
Now, I know that DeepMind was also involved in the COVID response. Can you tell us more about some of the work there?
Yeah, for sure. We were involved in the COVID response. So it is a good near-term example of how we were able to help somewhat in the COVID response and take some of the less well-understood proteins in the virus and determine their three-dimensional structure. And we actually made those available more broadly to the scientific community and the pharma community. That's something we were able to contribute kind of fairly early on in the COVID crisis and something we're very proud about, actually.
So Colin, last time we spoke, you mentioned some of the work that DeepMind has been doing with AI and sustainability. Can you talk to us more about what's going on there?
Yeah, for sure. So climate change is a tremendous challenge, actually, for humanity and something that's really important for us to think about as part of what we do. And in many ways, it's not directly applicable for AI. It's kind of an atoms rather than a bits and bytes problem, isn't it? It's kind of about pumping more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than we're taking back out again. But if we look at some of the underlying drivers of what's going on there, that's one where we can begin to think about, you know, how do we apply AI and our AI to kind of help improve things? And in particular, I think about the production of energy and the consumption of energy. You know, on the production side, we have done work to help green technologies, wind farms. That's something we've done quite recently and it's working very well. And Google actually was directly involved in this. And that's a piece of work I'm quite proud of. In the kind of mid to longer term, I think about fusion, for example, nuclear fusion. And one of the big challenges in nuclear fusion is how do you kind of control this kind of plasma? Very difficult. How do you control this plasma and make it stable? And actually, that is a really interesting application error for an advanced AI. If we could kind of help out there, then that would be a big leap forward on the production side. Then I think about on the consumption side, how do we make our energy consumption more efficient? And a piece of work we did with Google maybe a couple of years ago now is a great example here. So, you know, Google has a lot of data centers. They kind of get quite warm with all the computers running. And so there's actually quite a lot of energy that goes into keeping these data centers cool. And these are very complex systems, actually, very complex cooling systems. So what we were able to do was to work with our partners, which run these data centers, and develop a new system that was able to dramatically, I think about 30%, reduce the amount of energy required to cool those data centers. Now, if you scale that up across all data centers, that becomes quite significant. And I think what I'm looking forward to is how do we take that technology and how do we make it available to other organizations so they can do similar things, whether it's in commercial buildings or elsewhere. How do we reduce the energy consumption required for cooling buildings in general? I think being based in the UK, where we have a fairly kind of temperate climate, we don't think about it so much, but actually I think cooling of buildings accounts for a huge amount of energy use across the world today. So those are a couple of areas where I think about AI and, you know, its ability to have a really big impact on climate. And maybe linking back to our AlphaFold discussion a moment ago, Abby, is, you know, I think another interesting area is chemical production. So some chemical production processes require huge amounts of energy in the form of heat to make them work successfully. So if we could, through taking AlphaFold, design and develop perhaps new enzymes or catalysts to reduce the energy requirements in those systems, I think that's another way we could actually, through the use of AI technology, could have a pretty big impact on energy consumption in the world.
Right. I know it's especially timely now. Now, Colin, I would love to drill into your role in particular because you have a very unique role. What's involved in moving these new technologies from the lab and the research space into the marketplace? What's the process for you as you go about finding potential applications and matching them up?
Yeah, that is a great question. This is the perennial problem of how do you manage technology transfer? So we have an amazing group of researchers working towards this goal of solving intelligence. You know, many, many great ideas and breakthroughs produced on a weekly and monthly basis. And so the question is, how do you mine that bank of breakthroughs and find applications for that? So the way we think about it actually is we've kind of developed a new model for this. We spend time with our research team really getting to know and understand and keeping track of all the research breakthroughs that they're working on. We kind of build this bank of knowledge up, this kind of rolling store. On the other side, we've now really invested spending time with our colleagues in Google, really getting to grips with the sorts of product problems that they kind of grapple with every day. So we kind of build up these two banks, one of research and one of product problems. And then we kind of think about it actually as a matching process. So we've turned kind of tech transfer into a matching process. The idea being, if you can build a good live updating list of research and one of problems, then you can kind of match these two things together. And what we hope is, and what we're beginning to see is, that takes out some of the risk from the system. So that rather than having random acts of innovation, begin to move to kind of systematically backing winning ideas. Sometimes, Jack, with a team, sometimes it feels like we're kind of running a dating service. On one side, you've got research, on the other side, you've got product problems. And our job is to make that match. Maybe they have a first date, and if it works out well, great, off we go. And, you know, we're going into a product launch. I think we've kind of come up with this new model of how do you do tech transfer. And it's really exciting to see how that's evolving.
Yes, it's very exciting. One of the criticisms of artificial intelligence, especially in this early stages, is that it's a solution looking for problems. But with Google, you have a huge bank of problems to go after. How would you advise other developers in the field? How can they go about finding problems to solve?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I think it's really important to start simple. You know, pick a problem that you think you can have a meaningful impact on and pick a simple solution before you kind of get into the more complex AI solution. And actually, crucially important, engage your domain experts. It's really important. AI is great at solving a particular problem and really targeting an objective. But if it's not a problem that matters to you and your business, then it's probably not worth using AI to solve that. So domain expertise is super important. And I think the next thing I would say is data is key. If you don't have sufficient data, then your first step has to be to start to gather that data. AI lives and breathes on data. So you've really got to make sure you've got data in place. And I guess the last thing I would say is keep the faith. It's going to feel, certainly in the beginning, like there's maybe not much happening, especially as you're doing maybe the heavy lift around data. But AI is this learning system. And your job is really, in the end, to set up this feedback loop where the system ends up generating new data so that AI can continue to learn.
And are there opportunities for the community to get involved with the work of Google DeepMind, helping to solve some of the problems that you're trying to address?
So we, as a kind of matter of research, often share research papers and publications and then make available the sort of research problems that underpin that research so that others in the community are able to contribute their own skill and expertise to kind of pushing state of the art on those problems.
So if we can drill into a specific example, you talked about WaveNet earlier, and I'm assuming that's one of your matchmaking success stories. Are there other matchmaking stories from the past year that you would like to highlight or are particularly proud of?
Yeah, for sure. There's a piece of technology we call GraphNet now. And this is a piece of technology that we are finding a number of different use cases for across Google. But one of the, I think, the funnest ones is, you know, you realize now that when you jump in a car, at least I don't, you don't pull out the paper map and start to try and navigate to where you're going. You just simply put your destination into Google Maps. It tells you how to go. It tells you how to navigate around traffic. And you've arrived at your destination, you know, broadly when you expect to arrive. Super simple. I think there's over a billion kilometers actually traveled every day by people using Google Maps, which is pretty incredible, actually, if you think about the number of journeys that Google Maps is helping to enable. What we've been able to do with GraphNets is take that technology, work with our colleagues in Google Maps, and through a process of iteration, we've been able to kind of dramatically improve the estimated arrival times if you're using Google Maps, so that now you can have higher certainty and confidence that when your Google Maps is telling you when you're going to arrive, you can actually have high confidence that's when you are going to arrive. You know, and that was already a really accurate system. And I think this is to my point that You know, I think what we're able to do is DeepMind is just to kind of shift it to that next level with the expertise we have. That's one example I like. And I can give you another example as well, if you like. That'd be around Android.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Great. So Android is, I think, the kind of world's most popular operating system. Runs on, I think, most phones in the world. And whenever you talk to people that use phones, and I know this from my own family, everyone's always fighting for the phone charger in the house. We never seem to have enough. I've got three kids. You know, running out of battery is actually, when you talk to users, it's one of the biggest sources of anxiety I think there is in modern days. Like, oh, no, I can't do it without my mobile phone.
I've been there too many times myself.
Yeah, exactly. And so being able to kind of extend the battery life of phones is one of the top requests people make. We were able to do that with our team in Android. We were able to really understand how the Android system worked and how to extend the battery life of the phone. So there's a great example that you probably wouldn't realize was happening, but it's a real lifesaver for folks, including you and me by the sounds of it.
Great. Yes. And batteries are huge. I think we have them everywhere now, not just in our phones, but also in our cars. And certainly there's going to be greater applications even beyond what we have now.
Yeah, that's a great point. And actually, batteries are another good example, I think, of where, you know, going back to this sense of how does DeepMind solve some of these root node problems? You know, we're thinking about how do we do work in kind of material sciences? How does our technology begin to help understand some of the fundamentals of material science? And if we could crack that, then that would be another great boost for thinking about, you know, among many other things, how do we improve battery design? Because you're absolutely right. I mean, batteries are coming up everywhere now and can only going to get more important as we move to hopefully a greener, cleaner world.
I'd love to talk a bit about AlphaGo since, as I mentioned, that was my first introduction to DeepMind. Can you update us on where that project is? What are some of the applications that have come out of it?
For sure, yeah. It was an absolutely amazing moment. I remember it was shortly after I joined DeepMind, watching the game live and seeing AlphaGo perform with Lisa Dahl. It was not obvious at all when DeepMind started this project that this was even possible. In fact, a lot of people didn't think it was possible, and certainly a lot of people didn't think it was coming for decades and decades. And then, of course, when we got there, it was this amazing moment. And not just because we were able to perform so well, but because it really kind of opened up these new ideas and understanding about the game of Go itself, which people have been studying for thousands of years. And so actually, that in itself, I think, was remarkable for me. The idea that AI can be creative in this way, and AlphaGo was able to demonstrate that to us. I think that in itself is just worth kind of pausing and thinking about as we roll forward, where AI is able to help us create new ways of thinking. You know, since then, the team has done a great job in developing that technology. I think we took it and we've extended that, and it's able to play a variety of games now. So, you know, have a great kind of history and pedigree of working with games at DeepMind, and that's a kind of direction that the team has been very successful in extending it across. And then as I think about how do we apply that technology kind of against the problem store, as I described earlier. Well, kind of at its core, I think about some of the great big combinatorial problems that exist and how can we take AlphaGo or derivatives of AlphaGo and begin to solve for those. So maybe going back to the enterprise examples and, you know, simple things like how do you effectively plan a field sales force? You know, the classic traveling salesman problem. These are actually really interesting examples of being able to take these powerful technologies and, you know, solve things in a way that it's very difficult to solve today. Those are kind of a couple of examples that I'm pretty excited about. And you know, there are going to be others as we continue to develop this.
And what really strikes me about the breakthroughs in this space is that these strategy games, sometimes these worlds within these games, can be more complicated than the real world. So, for example, financial services or a healthcare system, or as you were describing, a human resources question. If we can already solve complicated problems within the gaming world, then it's likely that we can probably already solve some of the problems in the real world. That's what's super exciting, but also presents some challenges.
Right. Yeah, it's a great point. And I think we've had a lot of success with using these kind of simulated worlds at DeepMind. It's a great way to rapidly develop and then test the technology. And then the challenge is then, how do you transfer that to the real world? And of course, there is always a bit of a leap from the simulated world to the real world, but what we're able to do is get there, get the 80% there. And then that's what my team does, is spend that 20% on doing this matchmaking and then onwards developing and deploying it so that we've been able to kind of rapidly develop this technology and then transfer it on. You know, and you're absolutely right. Some of these games are very complex. And I think if you spend time deploying this sort of technology, then you realize actually the real world is pretty complex as well. It's kind of a bit rough around the edges in a way the simulations aren't. And so that is the kind of real skill of applying this technology that we've been able to develop over the years.
Walk us through that thought exercise of taking these breakthroughs in, for example, game theory or decision making, and then moving that into a specific field. What is that process like?
It kind of begins with this matchmaking process that we discussed earlier. So I have a team of product managers that are responsible now for making sure that we have a good fix on what are the problems that are out there in Google and maybe beyond. And then we have this bank of research. And so we periodically and quarterly, we run a session with the research team, the experts, product managers, where we try to identify this kind of match. And then we put that into a period of incubation, you know, 3 to 6 months, where we're really trying to prove out whether that technology does really work against the use case we thought it did. And of course, it doesn't always work out, but sometimes it does. And so we have this pipeline that we go through where we're trying to kind of, I guess, fail first in some ways, but then back these winners. So once we've been able to do that, then we'll kind of sit down more closely with the teams we know at Google and partner with them to deploy that in the first instance in their products and service. And if that goes well and it tests, then we'll grow and develop it from there. Of course, there may be like a version 2, 3, 4 of the research as well. There often is, which is very exciting. So once we've kind of set that highway up, we're then able to continue to deploy and develop the technology through that pipeline to drive further benefit and results. So that's kind of our pipeline. And that's a model we've moved to in recent years and is really, I think, beginning to yield some success. What I really hope is that we can go from random acts of innovation to systematic backing of winners, because I actually think that's how we're going to really get the benefit of this amazing technology. And I've been talking about Google. I just want to, I guess, remind myself and others that actually I think on the other end of that is billions of people. And I think what I get out of bed for is the belief that I think we can, with a relatively small team actually, take this technology and enrich billions of people's lives around the world. I think it's an amazing place to be.
Completely. And what else excites you about the future of artificial general intelligence?
When I think about, you know, AGI or artificial general intelligence, for me, it's, I guess it's a kind of growing cone of capability. I don't imagine we'll kind of, one day we won't have it and the next day we will. So within that, I think there are probably, for me at least, a few different kind of phases or sections. And maybe the first is broadly what we've been discussing, which is how do we use this technology to help digitize elements of our economy? How do we use it to develop new products and services? How do we develop it to better the lives of everyone in the world today? How do we kind of drive the economic engine, which has really enabled our progress? That's, if you like, phase one. We're in that phase at the moment. I think there's a lot more to develop. That's kind of where we are. And then if that's phase one, I think phase two is, you know, as the technology gets more capable, it begins to create itself. And this is where I'm very excited. This is about how do we begin to apply technology to these deep science problems? If you think about the kind of scientific resolution, you know, we had the economics, and the other thing that I think is really driven forward society is the ability to invent new things. And if we can begin to apply AI to that problem, drive the science engine, then I think we're already doubling progress. So we've got the economic engine, and then we've got the science engine. So that's really exciting.
And I think I get that sense in everything that you've been talking about. A lot of the work that Google DeepMind is doing is really the underpinnings for so many other scientific discoveries and breakthroughs.
Yeah, exactly right. Such a unbelievable and exciting place to be for that reason. And I guess as I roll out to the future, and this is, you know, becomes a bit fuzzier now, but if those two elements were economics and science, then, you know, in the long run, this is how I think about it. And maybe this goes back to what originally excited me when I first discovered DeepMind, is the way I think about it is in computer science terms, nature provides the platform or the OS, right? And everything else built on top has been built by humankind. So our civilizations, and actually by human intelligence. So if nature provides the platform, then everything else we've got on top is a result of human intelligence. So if we can begin to evolve the AI technology, and we can work with the AI technology of kind of what might be possible in the future. That, I think, is pretty awe-inspiring, and that, I think, is extremely exciting. For that reason, I think this is one of the most exciting times to be alive, actually, in the history of humanity.
Yes, I totally agree with you. How do you think your life is going to change as a result of the work of DeepMind over the next 10, 15, and 20 years?
One of the things that I think is easy to forget, and I forget, is that as soon as we get hold of a new piece of technology, you know, for a moment, it's very novel. And then within a week or a month, it just becomes part of our routine. I think that's one of the amazing things about human intelligence, our ability to adapt. I think if you were to stop to think about everything you can do today, you can talk to your phone, you can talk to your watch, and it talks back. That would have been kind of science fiction not too long ago, but now it's science fact. And to our point, you know, we have these amazing human-sounding voices now as well. 18 months ago, 2 years ago, that wouldn't have been possible. So I think it's really easy to forget, actually, that we're already feeling the benefits of this technology. And it's quite easy to kind of lose that. And I think over the next 10 years, I expect to continue to see that evolve and develop, and we'll kind of rapidly absorb these new advancements. If I imagine 10 years from now, I expect us to have made really quite dramatic advances in our underlying AI technology. And I think what's always difficult for me to do is to predict exactly where the next research will break the wall happen. So I think, you know, 2 years before we did AlphaGo or AlphaFold, would we have predicted them? Maybe not. We could have said there'll definitely be a big advancement, but we don't know exactly where it is. Directionally, we can say this technology is becoming increasingly capable. Exactly where that advancement will come from next, I think, is actually both the challenging but the exciting thing for me in my role at DeepMind.
I actually find that really fascinating. The application, this mental exercise of matching all the research breakthroughs, anticipating them, getting ahead of them, and then finding the right solutions. You've built this incredible process and it's working. And I can really see this becoming a model for future endeavors.
Yeah, I think it is a really exciting model. It's a kind of novel model and one that I'm looking forward to developing. We spoke about the process. You know, there is a little bit of magic in there as well. I think that's where the creativity happens, exactly that point. And I think to promote that creativity, maybe this touches a little bit on my background here. What I bring is this blend of expertise. I understand technology, I understand the product, I understand the business. So if you can get the right people in the room that are able to touch on all of these things and build the right culture so everyone's view is respected and heard, that's where I think you get that magic moment of that kind of spark of an idea, that ability to match. So there's a real cultural underpinning as well as like a very important process that we continue to work on and develop.
I'd love to just touch briefly on the topic of ethics and AI. We have another podcast earlier with Bernhard Trout, who teaches ethics and AI at MIT. But for DeepMind in particular, I'd love to hear about its approach to ethical AI.
Well, I think AI does and can have extraordinary benefits for humanity. But I think like all technology, it can have negative impacts unless we build it and use it in the right way. At DeepMind, we have various specialist teams thinking about how we build and deploy AI. You know, for example, we have a technical safety team. This is a group of researchers that work closely with our colleagues at Google, OpenAI, the Alan Turing Institute, and other leading labs to understand algorithmic technical safety. Then we have an amazing ethics team that work with many brilliant not-for-profits, academics, and other companies to create forums for society at large to explore some of these biggest questions. And I think something that's kind of important also is that when we think about applying the technology, we have partners and we have teams focused very clearly on how do we kind of manage the data sets and how do we set the training up and how do we set the right objectives and how we're evaluating all of that to make sure we're trying to eliminate bias from the system and make sure it's fair. And then I think zooming out, and something that's very important, I think, at DeepMind and for me, is that it's really important that the team building the AI and AI applications reflects, I think, and understands the diversity of the population that will be using those applications, which is why we really invest in that at DeepMind, actually, and why we also invest outside of DeepMind to enable this. For example, in university scholarships, in supporting community efforts in, you know, women in machine learning, and even the African deep learning endeavor.
Colin, one of the unique qualities that you bring to DeepMind is your management philosophy. And I think it would be of interest to our listeners to explore what that looks like from your end and how you approach management of the research teams at DeepMind.
Right. You know, that's a great question. Actually, I think the most important thing that any manager or leader can do, I think, is to set a very clear purpose for your organization or a business. That's, I think, the first thing that's really important. And then after that, I think complexity is something that is really very clearly a challenge for all leaders and managers in this day and age in any business or organization. And so the secret here, I think, is building the team and the culture and the processes that really allow us to integrate all these experts' opinions and insights in a kind of interdisciplinary way. Because in the end, with these complex problems, no one person now has all the answers. That's kind of super easy to say, but in reality, really quite challenging to do. You know, it requires really kind of high IQ, humility, compassion, and it's very tough. But at DeepMind, what we've been able to do, and it's been remarkable to be part of building, is combine the kind of bottom-up academic culture with the top-down, more company culture to create this blend of bottom-up and top-down. So what we've ended up with is intellectual freedom and scientific rigor with top-down resources. And it's created this culture which has actually been absolutely essential to all of DeepMind's successes. And it's not easy to build, but I recommend to anyone to invest in building that if they're interested in innovation.
Is that something you think is easier to build when you're DeepMind's no longer a startup, but it's its own entity within the larger Google structure? Does that help in building that culture, or is this something that you think can be applied more widely?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. Culture is a kind of a social phenomenon, and so you have to build the right kind of social fabric to allow that culture to develop and nurture. And so I wouldn't necessarily say you have to be a separate organization, but what you do need is some sort of separate identity and group social culture to enable that.
How can people who are interested in your work get involved?
Of course, we're open to hiring. So, check out our website. We also, regularly publish our work. So if you're in the machine learning community, you're probably aware of that already. If you're not, you can head to our website and take a look at some of our publications. And if you're not from that community, I think also we've got some amazing blogs where you can kind of read about some of our work. That's a great way to stay connected. There's actually a movie, I don't know if you watched it, Abby, AlphaGo movie, which I would thoroughly recommend.
The documentary, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's a documentary.
It's fantastic. I highly recommend it as well.
That's great. Yeah. So actually, that's probably the best way to get into it. Sadly, I don't think I made the cut, but you'll see a lot of other folks at DeepMind if you get a moment to watch that. I highly recommend it.
Well, Colin, I've really enjoyed hearing about the work at DeepMind. These breakthroughs from healthcare to strategic opportunities to sustainability, there's just so many exciting things going on. I'm looking forward to hearing more as you continue to move forward.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Abby. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
It's been a real pleasure to have you today.